I see new faces. Welcome. Welcome. My name is Edie, and I've been practicing here a long time, best to say. And I wanted to talk about creativity through the lens of practice. And when I first jotted down some notes, I decided, rather than saying creativity and art practice, when I put the "and" in there, it separated it. And so I invite you to think about what we're talking about tonight as creativity through the lens of practice, not separate. And I revisited a couple of books that I've really enjoyed. And the first one is Eight Gates of Zen. Very familiar, I'm sure, about different ways people show up, are curious, and express themselves. So The Eight Gates of Zen, John Dido Laurie wrote, the first gate is Zazen, which is what many of you just did when you were sitting here. Has anybody sat here for the first time tonight? Yes. Okay, welcome. Welcome to Zazen. So it's described as the still point and the heart of this practice. And what is Zazen? So when I talk about creativity and practice, I find it really hard to talk about it with words. It feels like it doesn't quite touch what I'm trying to describe, but there's no other way to give a talk. So here you go. So Zazen is being open and receptive. I think it's the heart of creativity. It's the heart of the creative process, and it's intimacy. And engaging in this process, it's trusting myself and trusting the process. And over the years, it's developing concentration, it's developing mindfulness, and it's a different way of being in space and time. And it especially comes up during Sesshin. Sesshin is a time when we sit extended periods of Zazen, and sense of time and space are very different, very unusual to day to day. So that's the heart of this practice and an entry point. Another way, gate number two, not necessarily in this order, but another gate is Zen study. And so what do we mean by Zen study? And it's ongoing exercise in fully meeting the moment, is how I would interpret Zen study. And then I was thinking of Darlene Cohen's book that I read just a few weeks ago, and she talked about simultaneous inclusion. So pulling in, fully meeting the moment, and pulling in the experience of what's going on right now, where there's no separation, there's no duality, there's a sense of interconnectedness and arising and disappearing and constant change. And it's it's not like you got it and you're done. It's like it's over and over again. So the third gate is academic study, studying the sutras, connecting to the ancestors through the sutras. So people have been here and practiced this way for a really long time, and I feel like when we read the sutras and chant the sutras, it's really connecting with so many people that have done this practice before. The other gate is liturgy, and another way to say that is making the visible invisible. And in Zen practice, we have a lot of ceremony. I see that as a dance, a ritual dance. And it's also, for me, it's like an enactment of the experience. Connecting with the ancestors, connecting my body, speech, and mind through ceremony. And every day is different. What comes out in the morning when we chant, and sometimes we're on key all together, and sometimes it takes a little while to get that. It's different every morning. So through our senses is really another way to experience the ceremony. And for me, also, orioki is a formalized way of eating during sesshin, and I love that ceremony of eating because it incorporates body, speech, and mind in the whole process. It's a rhythm of the body, a rhythm of the sounds, and quite enjoyable. So the fifth gate is right action and following the precepts. And when we sew our robes, we take on the precepts with intention, with thought. And part of that for me is also when I forget the precepts. And I forgot. I should have done it this way. So it's helpful to know what the precepts are and know when I fall short. The sixth gate is art practice. And for me, that is the most intimate experience for me, where there's no separation, there's no time, there's no space, there's no me that shows up. It's just what's going on. And it's not like I'm going to go into the studio and today I'm going to have this experience. It's just like sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. And when it does, I'm not there. It's like wonderful. So there are no words, there's no body, there's no way to fully communicate what that feels like. But I know that I get out of the way. There's no ego. It's just, wow, something happened. So I think also there's no narrative going on. You know, my mind gets really quiet. And I don't have that criticism. I don't have that so-and-so does it better, or I can't do this, or all that negative self-talk goes away. Another gate is body practice, and for me that's about taking care of the fruit of this practice, taking care of our body. We're so fortunate to be born as humans. And yet, that's a real egocentric point of view too, because what if I were a whale? Wouldn't I say, oh, I'm so fortunate to be a whale? You know, who knows? But I do feel like we're quite fortunate, and to treat all our senses with sacredness and all our daily actions with sacredness, and try to remember that. And then there's word practice, and Dido Laurie explains that one as sacred activity. And within word practice, there's a state of readiness, there's preparation, and I also think of that as zazen off the cushion. So it's so easy to sit here and feel great, and then I get on the freeway and I drive over the hill and I'm cursing at the driver next to me who won't let me cut in, you know. So I forgot. I just had a nice zazen moment and then I got on the freeway. So that too is work. And mindfulness and concentration when I get off the cushion is really where the rubber hits the road. It's not so much just sitting on the cushion. So attention to detail in my work practice, laying out my tools, getting prepared, thinking about my intention for the day at work, being fully present with patients, with coworkers, on the freeway. It's sometimes a challenge. So another book that John Dido Laurie wrote was Zen and Creativity. Anybody read this one? I love this one. So he talks about aspects of life and art and practice and how it's slightly out of reach. For me, it's always noticing what's on the peripheral vision of my experience. It's always, if I'm really mindful, I can notice what's on the edge of an experience. And that's where the creativity, I think, creeps in. So being open to that. And staying with the don't know, no matter how difficult or how uncomfortable, but just trying to explore some of the edges and giving some spaciousness to whatever's going on. So that involves trust in the spiritual practice. It involves trust in the creative process, trust in myself. And along the way, I find impermanence showing up in my life. I find timelessness in some ways, and spontaneity and playfulness. And none of those things are going to be on my list of things to do. They just graciously show up in my life. So awareness of impermanence is usually unfolding in ordinary ways. It's just, oh, you know, yesterday I saw four animals that, as I was driving home on a beautiful road outside of Woodside, and there were four animals on the road that had died for whatever reason, deer, raccoons. And so there's just a little reminder there about impermanence. Or the way the ocean looks today, I treat myself to a ride home on one every day after work. That's my treat. And every day it's different. It's impermanent, and it's ordinary as well. So, you know, looking at where the gaps are and looking at where there's no gaps, and I wanted to also say that when we do the ceremony, it's like a dance, and the spaces in between the dance, the time when we're chanting and there's no sound, you know, also noticing that, especially during oryoki, when people are eating so quietly. I appreciate that, the gaps. So how do we do this? How do we enter into creativity? Or are we already there all the time and we just don't have that space where we're noticing it or giving it space to develop? And I was thinking about somebody that I don't know if you've heard of, and I don't know if I say her name correctly, but it's Marina Abramovic. Yes?
Abramovich.
Marina Abramovich. Have you seen her movie? Oh, yeah. Well, Marina, her name doesn't exactly fly off your, you know, your tongue, but the name of the movie is The Artist is Present. And so creativity through this practice, I think she really manifests that in her expression. She had a show for 3 months from March to May in 2010 at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And she did 736 hours of 30-minute face-to-face eye contact with people who would show up. Isn't that like Dokusan? And you're just sitting there with somebody and giving them eye contact for 30 minutes. And she did this for 736 hours, 30-minute periods over a three-month time. And that's what the movie's about. And the movie's about how people responded to that experience. And it was just so beautiful. So she's got a new show that just finished. And if I had been in London before August 25th, I would have been able to report this back, but it was called 512 Hours. So she's the only material she used was herself and the audience and a few props, but they don't tell you what the props are. There was no photography allowed, and you had to literally and metaphorically leave your baggage behind. So you couldn't bring in anything. You couldn't bring in a watch, a jacket, a bag, electronic equipment. You had to just show up. And the way she is described as using her body as subject and object. And it's the way she expresses the relationship between art and nothingness. So I hope you can see the movie. I just love her work. And she has an artist's life manifesto, which is quite lengthy, but I thought I'd just mention a few parts of it. So an artist's relationship to suffering, she says an artist should suffer. And I'd like to say that maybe it could be we all suffer. And then she goes on, from the suffering comes the best work. Suffering brings transformation. Through the suffering, an artist transcends their spirit. And then she says, an artist's relation to inspiration. An artist should look deep inside themselves for inspiration. The deeper they look inside themselves, the more universal they become. The artist is universe. An artist's relationship with transparency. The artist should give and receive at the same time. Transparency means receptive, it means giving, and it means receiving. Doesn't this all sound like practice? An artist's relation to symbols. An artist creates his own symbols. Symbols are an artist's language. The language must then be translated. Sometimes it's difficult to find the key. An artist's relation to silence. An artist has to understand silence. An artist has to create a space for silence and to enter his work. Silence is like an island in the middle of a turbulent ocean. An artist's possessions. Buddhist monks advise that it is best to have 9 possessions in their life. A robe for the summer, a robe for the winter, a pair of shoes, a begging bowl, a mosquito net, a prayer book, an umbrella, a mat to sleep on, a pair of glasses. An artist should decide for himself the minimum personal possessions they should have. An artist should have more and more of less and less. Does this sound like a Buddhist? To me, it does. So, I think it's the space between the words that I enjoy the most of her work. So getting back to how do we do this, how do we find the quiet space within? How do we find the time for our practice? I just want to put in a plug for art and Zen and the arts program, and I think maybe Sally and Lori might comment on that at the end of the evening, but we do have a Zen and Arts program here. Should we take out the and? Just Zen Art? And also, I brought a friend along with me tonight. So this is something I did a couple of years ago, and you're welcome to come by and check it out a little closer, but it's a photograph that I manipulated. I took a photo in the garden out here in preparation for the 40th anniversary of the center. And what came out of that was, 40 years. Well, this is a personal meaning for me because this whole thing is called For a Moment. And each one of these cycles are like Dharma wheels for me. So one Dharma wheel is 40 years of practice, Zen practice in my life. And another 40 years is Dharma wheel of work practice, working in healthcare in lots of different roles. And my third wheel is art practice. And I can't explain it, I can't say why, but they all kind of show up somehow and intertwine. And so this is just one way of my working with that image, but I have a 3D image of what I want to do next with this idea because they're not separate. And how do they inform one another is a big question for me. So how do they inform one another? How are they interrelated in my life? Are they vertical or horizontal or circular or spiral? So my latest version of this is vertical. And stay tuned for 3D. And how are they integrated? So I think I over the 40-year period, it's always been pretty much the same questions. And I don't know if other people have had that experience of, you know, you come to Zen and you have a question and it kind of continues on in your life. Like, that question, it just keeps popping up. Different answers, over 40 years, but pretty much the same question. So question is, what's most important right now? That changes. And the other question is, what does it mean to practice wholeheartedly? You know, what does that mean? And if my intention is to practice wholeheartedly, how do I do that right now, given the situation and the circumstances that I'm in right now? So, same questions over 40 years. So my other inspiration here is A View from the Studio Door. Anybody read this one? Ted Orland? Oh, he's a local artist. And I unfortunately missed his classes at Cabrillo. He hasn't been teaching there for a while, but Ted Orland, A View from the Studio Door, and he offers suggestions for bringing art practice into daily life. And it all sounds like what we're doing right here. So he talks about intention. He talks about having a place in your life for this practice, creating a space for it. And doesn't that sound like what we do here? Intention, a place in your life for this practice. Ramping up time. So ramping up time is a practice period. It's getting ready for Sesshin. It's finding preciousness not only in the doing it, but in the getting ready to do it. It's like, yeah, I'm getting ready for Sesshin now, or this is going to be a practice period, or I'm going to go to a one-day sit even, you know. It's like very precious time. And working with materials you love. So I love to work with cloth. I always have my blankie with me, even on a hot evening. Cloth is really important to me. So working with materials you love and experiencing what you love through all your senses. So I also work with indigo dye pots. I love the smell of indigo. There's nothing better than to get over an indigo dye pot and take a really good whiff. So every step along the way, finding places where in my life there's interconnection, you know, there's no separation really. They're not the same. I'm not saying that practice is the same, but it's certainly not separate. You know, it's, yeah, it's interconnected. And the last piece that Ted Orland talked about was finding a community to support your practice, a community of artists. And isn't that like what we say about the importance of Sangha? So finding a community that supports it. And also I'd like to add that I meet some people and we connect in a way where I can look at that person and say, I can see the artist in you. You know, whether it's how they use language, how they write, how they work with stone, how they cook, how they work with children. So being able to say, I see the artist in you. Is that any different, or is that the same as saying, I see Buddha nature in you? I don't know. Sometimes there's a sense of honor, honoring something. So, David White? Anybody? Yeah, David White. Okay, one of my favorites. Talks about all the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. There's only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. So, kind of getting back to words don't quite reach those secret vows. And what to remember when waking is one of my most favorite that he's written. And part of that is what to remember when waking. What you can plan is too small for you to live. What you can live wholeheartedly will make plans enough for the vitality hidden in your sleep. To be human is to become visible while carrying what is hidden as a gift to others. You are not a troubled guest on this earth. You are not an accident amidst other accidents. You were invited from another and greater night than the one from which you have just emerged. I like thinking that we're here by design tonight. So, I guess my biggest question for you, and I hope you'll respond, is where does creativity show up in your life? Think about that. Where does creativity show up in your life? And the other question is, where does practice show up in your life when you're off the cushion? You know, when we were sitting zazen, I was hearing music outside, I think in the back here, And it reminded me of those little pop-up, you know, you would turn the crank and up would pop like a clown or something. And when I would play that for my son when he was pre-verbal, he would start to dance. And nobody told him how to dance. Nobody said, this is how you dance, or this is when you dance. He was just reacting to the music. And that's what came up for me when I was listening to that sound, and I thought, that's so innate, you know. And so I think creativity is like that. And how do you create the space, spaciousness in your life? I mean, I deal with that too. You know, I have this much time, and it's not like I can set the clock and say, okay, now I'm going to be out in the studio and I'm going to do something great. You know, it's hard to find time. And I think of all the people that have really made it out in the world, it's not about fame and fortune, it's about, you know, did I do something completely? It's so satisfying that it doesn't really matter if somebody sees it or not. It's just a sense of completion. And then it's like, and then it's over. That sense of completion is over because I want to create something else. I don't know if that answered.
You have a couple of years. Move away. Thank you so much for your talk.
Chuck?
I think practice, formal practice, is real evident for a lot of people. And carrying over your practice into your life is not so evident, and yet you see it after a while more and more clearly. And I have this feeling that art is kind of similar, and that I regret that I don't allow enough time for formal practice of art. And yet I see it materialize in a lot of ways that are much more subtle than, say, the formal practice of art. Mm. So I think this practice has actually allowed me to see a larger view of how things show up in general and how we perceive them.
It reminds me of Minor White's photography and approach to seeing. And after Sesshin or during Sesshin, do you notice the colors and the patterns so much more? Is that kind of how you're describing it, how it shows up? It's like, oh, I didn't see that little bit of yellow and green in that inside of that flower before.
Well, and like Nanette indicated, watching a grandchild all day, yeah, it's actually an extension of practice. You know, letting go a little bit of what you think everything should be, mm-hmm, and allowing the spontaneity of what is and responding to it as, mm-hmm, well as you can. Being more moment to moment with kind of everything, yeah, all of our interactions.
So I said creativity and art practice, and then I crossed out art practice and art practice, because creativity through the lens of practice is what you're describing. It's not certain efforts.
I'm really trying. trying not to freak anyone out right now because I'm so happy I could, you know, scream because it's just beautiful. Everything that you're saying, that you're bringing this here. So, with that, hearing how you work and the experience that you have while you work, a sense of timelessness and the no self, and sort of, you know, for myself, this abiding in this non-dual place. My question for you is, who opens the door to your studio?
There's nobody there other than intention. I know when I need to be in the studio because I get really crabby. It shows up. It's like, oh, I need to be in the studio because I'm really crabby. So, and sometimes in morning zazen, when I'm supposed to be doing morning zazen, I'll have this great idea. And I just have to rush home and get in the studio. So it makes me smile. Yeah.
And so I also want, you know, Amanda kind of affected me when she was talking. And I just wanted to say that it takes a lot of patience, and I understand where you're coming from. And, you know, it's sort of like, I think you have to question, what is it that the practitioner is creating? Like, what do we really want to end up with? And Chuck was sort of touching on this spontaneity of it. I just think that, at least for me, it's the expression of suchness that I think the practitioner might be wanting or having an aspiration for. And it takes, like, sometimes my teacher would say it takes 99 failures for one success. And for me, it's like 900 failures. Mm-hmm. For one success. And that's the life of the practitioner and the artist. It's, you just keep getting up, and all it is expression. It's not, I don't know, that's how it is for me. And that, I've seen it so many times, how people say, oh, I can't do this. And I know it seems like it's easy for artists, but it's really not. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that anybody in this room can do that. Because it's all about practice.
Yeah, I always kind of turning over the thought of a lot kind of like what you were just saying. Some ways about self-expression, the notion of self-expression, and you know, that feeling of creativity is expressing ourselves. And, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, is there a self? Is there not a self? What is that feeling? And I guess what came up for me was, I think very much in line with what you were saying. It's kind of like the big self, you know, is what we're expressing, and then we kind of lose the little self. We're in touch with the big self, and that's why it feels so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Similarly, I think kind of like the joy of sashin is just being able to take in through your senses the fullness of what's there all the time. and you don't see it, you know. And you think about little instances lately that just I've experienced a lot of joy, like just hearing a piece of music on the radio that it was just like, didn't even really matter. I didn't know the artists, I didn't know what all the instruments were playing, but just like, the music was just so full, it was just happening, you know. And I had the joy of just like listening and hearing that, felt like just kind of, it was just kind of an experience of appreciating the world that felt like, I just felt happier for appreciating the creativity of the world. And for me, I think a lot of times when I, if I notice that I am more appreciative, it's because for whatever reason I have the grace that I'm not thinking too hard. You know, I'm not like trying to manage the world in my mind. So I had a conversation this afternoon with somebody on the phone, and it just felt like they were describing kind of a complex situation, and it felt really full to just be able to hear that already the gift had been given in the situation because the intention was expressed. And it was like, oh, it's already happened. No matter what happens after that with this piece of property, just the person's intention to give it feels like it's already, the gift is already given in the world, you know, like just this swirling world has already manifested itself, and we're a little step back.
So the world comes forward.
Yeah, thank you.
The world comes forward. Creativity shows up, doesn't it?
And when I'm in a garden and it feels creative, sometimes I berate myself because I'm like, whoa, I don't have a list. I am not going in a logical progression. I am just, you know, being childlike and just responding to the next thing. Responding. But there's so much joy in responding.
Yeah.
Sometimes it feels like I can do that.
Playfulness is really important. So, thank you. Wow, 7:30. So, hold it, stand. Yes, one more. Go ahead.
I was very blessed to grow up in a musical family. My mom was a pianist, coloratura soprano, composer, puppeteer. She did art. And art did its thing through her. So I started singing very young and had been doing it all this time. And it is that same kind of union of becoming one with the piece and the composer that wrote it. And feeling that, being very tight, I'm now in the church choir, but I just joined last night Cabrillo Symphonic Chorus with Cheryl Anderson, who's the director of both, and she's awesome. But she demands a lot out of you. You really have to be there and have to listen and have to, and now it's 4-hour rehearsals every Monday or Tuesday. But we're doing it. We're going to have a beautiful, shouldn't say this, Christmas concert over at the church, Christmas concert that they do every year, and we're using just gorgeous pieces. But it's that wonderful kind of feeling of being really in the music. And what I experience in sitting here, and I love it just as much, is a silent symphony of being really one with ourselves and each other in a way that's so deep we can't put it into words.
Yeah.
And I thank you all for that. For the last year I've been doing it with you, and think we will continue to do so for as long as I live.
Thank you, Stan. So may this talk generate creativity in all beings are numberless. I